Session number 6184, reel 5.
Mr. Woodhouse, tape 5.
Within 5 minutes of being in these air raid shelters, the Japanese themselves have been knocking that are asking for a light for their own cigarettes. As long as we could get four chaps together in one of these shelters, we're all right. Because we'd no matches, and it must be puzzling the Japanese to this day to find out how we lit cigarettes, but all it needed was four men. One would have a piece of steel boot heel, one would have a small flint, pardon me, one little piece of bamboo ring, a bit like a table napkin ring. The other one, a piece of dry kapok or wadding. All you needed really to make a tinderbox was to stuff the wadding into the little ring of bamboo, hold the flint between the finger and thumb, strike a spark on it with a piece of steel, and blow it up, and you had a tinderbox. You could have lit 100 cigarettes. But apart from the separator, they meant nothing to a searcher at all.
There was quite a fuss made about not smoking, was there?
Oh, yes. Yes, they didn't like it. But they depended on us for a light.
How were you paid for your work?
There we were paid... Well, it started off with 10 cents a day, but they started paying us in kind, finally. They gave us some cigarettes, 10 cigarettes every 2 days. These poor quality Kinseys, they were known as. Until that dried up, I think the factory was bombed, that dried up. And they started sending fruit in, like persimmons and the small oranges and that sort of thing.
Was there a lot of... competition for cigarettes?
Yes, there was. There was always somebody, of course, who would trade food for cigarettes. And I gave up smoking for a time because I thought, well, survival's much more important than smoking, and I managed to do it. And I would have been a non-smoker, really, right the way through. I'd just become a non-smoker, it's true, seven years ago. But I would have been a non-smoker from that time had not some of the first things the Americans dropped to us in great number when they started to supply us from there was cigarettes and tobacco and so on.
When the camp was bombed, did that affect the way you lived very much?
It affected the Japanese attitude. They became a bit harder. They didn't tell us, of course, but they were getting news of how accurate it was, one doesn't know, but it was quite clear that the writing was on the wall then. Because if the Americans could bomb Japan, and it meant they had carrier-based aircraft very close at hand, or they were at least on Okinawa, which was the nearest island.
So what did you feel? You must have had divided feelings when you were...
We had very divided feelings. We were looking forward to some sort of release, but we didn't want to be killed before it happened. I bet this has happened all over the place, I suppose, to prisoners, but nothing new. We didn't know where we were going to be bombed or by how much or what. Neither did the Japanese. They had no defences. We never saw a Japanese aircraft. They couldn't defend themselves, and the guns they had, I think, couldn't cope with the sort of height these aircraft would fly at.
Did you encounter any other Japanese civilians apart from the ones you worked with?
We came across some women, and of course the Japanese management, factory management, were civilians too. They paid lip service. One nice old boy was the factory manager. He paid, at least for appearance's sake, I suppose, he paid a certain amount of lip service to the military influence by turning up at the factory in sort of correct morning clothes, but he'd have khaki putties well and halfway up his legs and a military cap on top of it. It looked rather grotesque. But even at that time, it must have been obvious to the industrialists that they couldn't go on very much longer because the zinc plant had run really out of zinc ore at that time, and our last work was clearing the place up to a large extent. And there was a lot of stuff lying about which meant nothing to me. A lot of plant and that sort of thing looked very rusty and that sort of thing. And one of the chaps said, well, I don't know, I reckon there's all this stuff here. They could switch production in this factory, something quite different in a very short space of time with the stuff they've got there. So I don't think the Japanese civilian, or at least the industrialists, were unprepared for the end of the war and to take on something quite new.
And the women you encountered, were they quite friendly?
They were quite friendly. At that time, I don't know what it's like now, it was a very feudal sort of outfit. Women had no say in things at all, as far as one could judge. I first encountered them, really, when we had been working in the zinc foundry. We were called, a party of us were taken aside to build or dig the foundation for some sort of war memorial for the Japanese. And we worked all morning. I mean, it was quite hot, and I was suffering from a recurrence of malaria, really. till lunchtime, and I found have a temperature at over 104, so they took me away from it. But in that time, we got a bit of a break and wandered over to get a drink of water from some Japanese houses, very poor little houses nearby, and the number of women, they started feeding us soya milk and showing every sign of, you know, friendship or friendliness. Quite well disposed. I think they also realised that, I think women realise quicker than anybody else the sheer futility of warfare.
And was food reduced as the end of
it? It got worse. It got less. I think the whole of Japan was short of food. What had been an acceptable ration when we first went there became smaller and smaller. The rice became less and the meat became less. I think at one time they were sending in large dogs into the camp as a meat ration. Vegetables got scarce, and on one occasion everybody on the island, I think, suffered from a sort of internal qualms, only the fact that they had a lot of whale meat went around. I think it was bad. We all had it, and we were bad for a long time. So were the civilians.
What sort of proportions were you getting?
They decreased, really. That, of course, and the work was hard. It was. We got really to the same stage as we were in Siam to some extent. But there was no immediate prospect of getting more food, and that's where the weight really started to fall off us, and the chaps were getting really skeletal at that time, toward the finish. It was very thin. I was down to something like little over, I mean, about 7 stone in weight, under a normal weight as a young man then of 10.5 stone. But I wasn't the worst by any means. There were chaps worse off than me.
What sort of illnesses were current?
Well, again, you see, it was sort of general weakness. Engendered by the sort of work we were doing and lack of food. Plus, of course, the long-term effects of weakness started with things like malaria and dysentery. Dysentery continued to some extent because food wasn't sufficient to form any binding agent, and what we called dysentery at one time, a slackness of bowels, was later replaced by the sheer inability of muscles to control bowel movements. This was the point.
Were there any drugs for the medical officers to use?
Very little. We had what was laughingly called a hospital, which was a place where one could rest if you were bad enough. But the treatment was, they gave us nothing. The Japs wouldn't give you any medical supplies. To them, we were regarded as expendable labour. It's as simple as that.
How soon did you learn that the end of the war was?
We learned about 3 days, I think it was, after the actual event, because we saw, I mean, I'm certain that we saw the final act or part of it, because one morning over went a single aircraft well up over Amuta, and we were as usual hustled out from the zinc foundry into these air raid shelters and stayed there until well after midday, where we were told to eat our food and so mishy. And then when we were finally let out of these air raid shelters, we found that the Japanese camp sergeant major had arrived with some other guards to march us back to camp. And way along in the distance we could see a heavy, sort of tremendous heavy cloud right up. We didn't know what it was. And on the way back, marching back to camp, we saw a number of people gathered around the stumps of telegraph poles reading what appeared to be some sort of official pronouncement. And got back to camp, we were told, we were given a parcel of Red Cross food between two men, which we'd never had before, although there were plenty in the camp, the Japs had been using them themselves. We were told there would be no lights out that day, that night, and every man would yazume, that would be a rest day tomorrow, no work. And it added up to us, to the fact that the war was over, although we didn't dare to believe it. And we stayed in that state for 3 days before it was announced officially. And then our officer really had gone to the Japs, commandant, who was never a popular man, and said, "I believe the war is over. If it is so, I must insist that you announce it. But before you announce it, I would advise you get all your men out of the camp, because I can't guarantee the conduct of my men, bearing in mind what's gone on in this camp, as you well know." And with the following morning, it had all gone, it was announced the war was over, and then we started to spread ourselves. Raided the Japanese stores, distributed clothes to a lot of civilian workers, got food from outside, and they have chickens and so on, and began to live, get ourselves clean.
You mentioned that you received a Red Cross parcel. Was that the only one you received?
It wasn't the only one. We'd had one a Christmas before, which was shared between, I think, eight men. One parcel between eight men. And it wasn't enough, but it was useful.
What was in your...
Well, the usual sort of thing. There was a tin of meat, there'd be coffee, some tea, there'd be ration chocolate, raisins, a tin of milk, sugar, and so on. And our first thing, really, one never knows how quickly these things take effect. And it's rather curious. I've mentioned this several times since. The first one we had, shared between eight men, we took all the sweet things out, the raisins, the chocolate, the powder of milk and sugar, and made a sort of paste of them. Now, we were all very cold. There was no heating in these huts. We had khaki drill clothing and run-down canvas shoes. Our feet were never really warm or dry throughout the whole winter. We were cold. And our diet was so low at that time that whatever you put in the body, there was an immediate effect. And we each had some of this appalling mixture of milk powder, sugar, chocolate and raisins. And within half an hour, we all felt considerably warmer. It was really quite surprising. You know, nobody realises until the diet is really low how it affects the body when immediately. You have no means of telling. It's really quite strange. But the food we got laid, the parcel between two men, is a different matter, of course, and then we realised there were a lot more parcels in the place they'd never distributed, although they were using them. And then we started to get at that. And I say getting food from outside. And we stayed there for a month before the Americans came and collected us.
Did anyone parachute into the camp?
Didn't parachute. They used to drop messages. We had, you see, so much food was being dropped at that time that we didn't know, really. We had more food than we needed in our camp. And it was quite clear there must have been other camps near at hand. So the thing to do was to establish contact with them, find out how many men there were, and then organise, so we didn't know how long we'd be there, and then organise some sort of central dispersal point for food. And I was sent out with one party, and we found a Chinese camp who may have been there longer than we had. The idea was to get numbers, of course, and go back and report where precisely the location of the camp, so that future arrangements could be made to level the thing out on an equitable basis. And it was quite a good job. But we were told we'd be collected on a certain day, almost exactly a month after the capitulation. And we expected, really, to be lined up and counted. And in fact, we got lined up ready to be counted by midday. We were told that at that midday, representatives would come and take us away. And we all expected something on the British Army pattern, where you'd have had at least two or three brigadiers and lieutenants general and counting through and humping kit and this sort of thing. But at 12 o'clock, two scrubby-looking American sergeants chucked and shoved their head through the gate of the camp and said, "Oh, the camp 17, okay, fellas, let's go." Yeah. And we simply wandered down to the railway station and then down to Nagasaki, where we embarked on the cruise of the Mobile, after a nice hot bath on the quayside. You know, the Americans work wonders. They, in a very short space of time, they put a miniature reception centre there. So bags of hot water, bags of soap, and complete change of clothing, and every smallest need anticipated, even a row of beads for the Catholics. It was really quite astonishing. All the food, of course, you wanted in small doses, cigarettes, ad lib, and there was that lovely ship waiting to take us away from the place. Put together with big, hefty American Marines to help you up the gangplank if you wanted it, would carry your kit for you. It's a wonderful feeling.
Did you accept the offer of help?
No. I had a big kit bag full of stuff, but I staggered up the last night. I said, "Give us your bag." I said, "No thanks, our son." I said, "Look, I walked into this bloody country, I'll walk out of it, and luckily I made it without falling on my chin straps." But it was very nice. I couldn't settle for the first couple of hours, to be honest with you, neither could other chaps. There was a film show on the film that on the board that night. It showed American life of one of the American presidents. Good colour film. And there was a very good band playing. I remember the tune now, A Sentimental Journey. I can still remember it. But I couldn't sleep. I couldn't settle to sleep. And I sat on the upper deck smoking all night. By the next morning, I'd readjusted to some extent, I think. And I've never had any hang-ups since then.
Mm. In the initial drops of food, had anyone been hurt?
Yes, two chaps were injured. One lost his legs and one was killed because they were dropping things initially in large 44-gallon oil drums, which were lashed to parachutes. In one case, it was not too securely because the thing came off the parachute and crashed to the roof of the hut. It was rather tragic.
And what were conditions like in the Chinese prisoner of war camp?
Well, worse than ours. They'd been there a lot longer and they hated the Japs. The Japs didn't like them and they hated the Japs even more than we did. They, before they would consider any sort of counting of numbers at all, they'd made us welcome. They made us sit down and have a meal with them, typical Chinese fashion, charming people. And then their next question was if any of our chaps wanted any souvenirs to go home with. One of the chaps expressed a wish for a Japanese sword, which was provided because a party went out, and I certainly must have found some unfortunate Japanese after and killed him and took his sword off him, brought it back. At that time, it was a question really of complete anarchy. There's no doubt about that. The civilian administration had fallen down. The police weren't, Japanese police weren't really interested. And it was devil take the hindmost. It probably soon recovered with a disciplined body, but see, this wasn't Tokyo. This wasn't. Well, Nagasaki didn't exist anyway. This was a small town called Omuto, and it was half demolished anyway.
What sort of reception did you get when you went out into Omuto from the?
Well, not too bad, because we were carrying with us. You see, we were carrying with us all sorts of gifts. We'd broken into the Japanese store, and most of these chaps, these Japanese, were short of food, of clothes. And they were all in and out of Japanese boots and uniforms. And we took them out and distributed a pair of boots to these chaps working outside. They were delighted. They were quite happy to meet us.
And did you actually travel through Nagasaki?
Yes, we came through. Of course, we embarked from Nagasaki. It was a month after, of course, the atomic bomb had fallen. But it was a frightening prospect, really. It was I don't know how you do describe it. It was a total devastation, and that was a small, primitive, almost hand-thrown atomic bomb, if one can so describe it. But the devastation was utter. If you can imagine an area 100 square yards which has 10 sort of blockbusters dropped on it, with the result that the remains of H-girders sticking out of the grounds are twisted like fish hooks into all sorts of grotesque shapes. And I don't think they cleared all bodies away at that time. The place still stunk a bit in places. And the harbour, of course, where the ship was, the remains of ships stuck out of the water had been sunk. And oddly enough, we took that in our stride. As far as we were concerned, the war was over, and it was their damn fault they'd started it.
How long did it take you to get back home?
They sailed us from there to Okinawa, where fighting was still going on, in fact. We stayed there one night, and we then flown down to Manila, and from Manila to a place called Laguna de Bay, just outside Manila, to a dispersal camp, which the Americans had again rigged up with great imagination. It was tremendous. They were thinking in bigger terms all the time. They'd made this dispersal camp to sort out nationalities principally and to fatten us up a bit and kit us up. And they were house tents. There were two men to a big house tent raised off the ground several feet on planks and boards and iron bedsteads, the blanks, pillows and sheets and bedside tables and open air Coca-Cola bars and, oh God, and cinema. You've never seen anything like it in your life. You didn't need a mosquito net or a mosquito bar, as they called it, because they sprayed an area 50 square miles with DDT every day. There was no need for it. And then, having sorted us out, they sent us our various ways. We came across the Pacific from Manila to San Francisco and across Canada on the Canadian National, stopping at Tacoma. And then onto New York, where we boarded the Queen Mary and back to England, Southampton on, let me say, early December 1945.
What's your main sort of memory of your prisoner of war times? I mean, has it affected you in any lasting way?
No, I don't think so. I lost teeth. They would have gone anyway by now at my age, I dare say. And my hair's never been thick, and I've got a few ulcer scars. But other than that, I don't think I've suffered, really.
Do you have any?
But I'm singularly lucky. Very lucky indeed.
Do you have any hard feelings towards the Japanese?
I don't like them. I suppose the present generation, given the same conditions, will do much the same thing again. I don't think you alter national characteristics in two or three decades. But against that must be set the fact that I've met a Japanese since who I've quite liked. Japanese women particularly, and not for the obvious reasons, but the little Japanese girl who got married to somebody, and you're in this kind of charming little creature, came all this way, got married, carried herself with tremendous aplomb. We had a speech at her wedding and a reception, which I thought was brilliant. And I couldn't imagine many English girls doing it in Japan, to be honest with you. But it's rather amusing. When I was at, until I was a little over a year ago, in charge of Stonehenge as head custodian, if we ever had Japanese who did this kick over the traces at all, which wasn't very often, I must say. They seem to be very concerned to be seen to be doing what they think is the right thing in some of the other people's countries. Now, anyway, I'd only have to lapse into Japanese and tick them off a bit sharp. You have them standing to attention, sort of bowing to me. Rather amusing.
Thank you very much.